A Southern Illinois mother is facing thousands of dollars in hospital bills for her newborn because of Medicaid enrollment delays, and she's one of more than 100,000 facing problems with the program in Illinois. Plus, state lawmakers have just 2 weeks to decide how they'll move forward with several pieces of legislation. The House Republican leader joins us to share his priorities in these last few days of session. And the story of the Chicago drag queen who ran for president in 1992.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that's coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, more than 100,000 Illinoisans have been waiting more than 45 days for their Medicaid applications to go through, even though that's actually against federal law for the state to keep patients waiting that long. Plus, we'll be talking about a play at Steppenwolf that tells the true life story of a Chicago drag queen who ran for president in 1992. But first, the legislative session ends next Friday. I don't know what your to-do list looks like, but our state lawmakers have a pretty long one, especially Democrats who swept into power with a new governor and supermajorities in both chambers. There's an infrastructure bill, sports betting, legalizing cannabis, and of course, passing a budget. What are Republicans prioritizing in this home stretch, and how much bipartisanship are we really going to see both in these next couple of weeks and beyond? Representative Jim Durkin is the House Minority Leader. He's a Republican from Illinois' 82nd District, some of Chicago's west and southwest suburbs, including LaGrange, Willowbrook, and Burr Ridge. I spoke with him earlier this morning. Representative Durkin, welcome back to the 21st.
My pleasure.
A draft of the Capitol bill was released to leaders on Friday. It's a $41.5 billion plan. Governor Pritzker is calling it Rebuild Illinois. And there's lots of ideas for revenue in here, including doubling the state gas tax to 38 cents per gallon. It's at 19 cents now. What in there do you support?
Well, you know what? We're still going through it. But all I can say is that I support that we have this idea of doing a capital bill. But there's many things in here that I can't support, nor will my caucus support. This plan is the governor's plan. This is not the legislature's plan. This has not been negotiated with the four caucuses. So I will say that we'll continue to work over the next 2 weeks. But this plan in itself will not pass the sniff test with the House Republicans.
So what revenue methods would House Republicans support in a capital bill?
I think that we've traditionally looked at possible expansion of gaming. There's some issues we can do with MCOs. And there's, I would say that some other areas that are more of voluntary types of revenue enhancements that have been negotiated with the parties that are affected by it. But you know, when you get into bag tax, cigarette tax, streaming taxes, those are things that our caucuses have to support.
So I know that you said this is the governor's plan. What have you been working on with your Democratic colleagues in terms of a bipartisan capital plan? And what's the timeline for presenting that?
I will say that the House Republicans have been working with the House Democrats within a working group on capital for the past 2 months. They are close to reaching some type of a strong foundation for us to work from. It is still being hammered out, but it will be different from the governor's. And our goal is to put the least impact upon Illinois citizens. We know that you have to pay for these things, but we have to do everything we can to minimize the impact upon the middle class and the people that got to get up and go to work every day.
So, Representative Dirk, we're kind of in crunch time here. When is this something that you all plan to present before the end of session?
Of course, yeah, we want to get this done by the end of the month. And I do know that if Democrats seek to engage the Republicans on major issues, we can get things done. I've done this before on last year's budget. I did it with education funding reform. And this is a big issue. It's an important issue. It's been talked about for a long time. And I'll just say that if the Democrats want to get it done, they're going to need Republican support. And Republican support means more than just us providing votes. It means our input will have to be taken serious and will have to be incorporated in the final product.
So to that point, I wonder if I can ask you about marijuana legalization. Last week, Senator Jason Berkman, a Republican who has supported legalization, told the Tribune he disagreed with a part of Governor Pritzker's plan that would include a provision to allow some people who have been convicted of marijuana-related offenses to have their records expunged. Of course, he's in the Senate. I wonder where you and your House Republican colleagues stand on that part of the proposal.
That part of the proposal is a non-starter with us. We do not believe in this blanket expungement that has been offered by the governor, in which he has said that he wants to expunge criminal backgrounds, even felony convictions for drug offenses, marijuana offenses, for people to work in the industry. I mean, that's absolutely, it's ludicrous. So to say that in this type of situation that the prosecution and the people that tried the cases would not be able to object or at least have their voices heard is wrong. It's not how we should go about this process. This is wrong. It's on many levels. It's one of the many things that I find problematic with the bill. Every day that goes by, the Republicans in the House are, I would say, looking at it with a more concern. So I think it's going to be a very heavy lift to be able to accomplish this. I don't believe that the revenue, which is all this is about, it's about revenue. The revenue is, it's not predictable. It is not going to stop the illegal black market of marijuana trafficking and dealing in the streets of Chicago and other parts of the state of Illinois. And thirdly, it sends the wrong message to teenagers and youths about what our feeling is on this product. I mean, I was with Governor Pritzker 2 months ago, and I stood next to him when he signed Tobacco 21. And the whole goal is to make sure that this evil nicotine, you know, we got to keep this away from teenagers and youths. And it seems very hypocritical that at the same time he's saying that, but he wants to make marijuana a legal product in Illinois that you can purchase, off shelves of a dispensary. I just can't accept it.
Representative Durkin, I wonder what your response is, though, to many Democrats or others who say that the expungement part is important because it addresses the fact that current drug laws have disproportionately affected communities of color.
Well, you know, I'm not going to speak about who deals drugs and where do they deal drugs. But the fact is the laws of Illinois are colorblind, and there is a process in place for individuals with criminal backgrounds to be able to appeal to the courts, to have their convictions sealed or having them removed. I have supported many expungement pieces of legislation over the past many years at the request of members of the Black Caucus. And look, I come from a background as being a narcotics prosecutor in Chicago. I know a little bit more about the drug trade than most people in both the House and the Senate. But the governor has the inherent right on his own to be able to commute sentences, to do this without having to go through this arbitrary process of saying that everybody who has been convicted of a felony offense or a misdemeanor offense for related to cannabis is no longer going to have that on their background. At some point, we have to respect the laws that we have in the books. If the Democrats want to completely repeal the narcotics and the drug statutes in the Illinois, under Illinois revised statutes, put a bill forward and do it. But to say that, you know what, we're not going to take this serious anymore. People who deal with drugs, people who have destroyed neighborhoods, you should be given the opportunity to have a, this expungement, this commutation, whatever you want to call it, for the purposes of putting them back into the legal trade doesn't make any sense to me. It's not right. We should observe the laws as we currently have them on the book. If people don't like the way in which the laws and the penalties have been meted out, then change those laws, change the sentencing code. But to do this for the purposes of making is an enticement. This is what this is. This is an enticement that the governor is doing for a certain member, certain groups of caucuses within the General Assembly to get this passed. It's just, it's not right. We're moving too fast on this anyway. And it's the wrong signal that we're sending to people in Illinois that, you know, we're going to be, we want to be as progressive as these other states on the West Coast and a few other on the East Coast. But this is not the Illinois that I want to live in.
Can I ask you one last question? I know you have to go,
yes.
But last week, of course, Alabama passed a law that bans nearly all abortions in the state, makes it a crime for doctors to perform abortions at any stage unless a woman's life is threatened. Supporters have made it clear they hope this state law ultimately makes it to the Supreme Court and results in the overturning of Roe versus Wade. I wondered your thoughts on this law, if you hope that will happen.
I don't have any opinion on that at all. I'm concentrated on the budget and also concentrating on issues that are important to Illinois, like a capital program, balanced budget. I'm not going to opine about what other states are doing on any given issue.
So what about here in Illinois? There is a big rally this evening in Chicago for the Reproductive Health Act, saying that should be passed here in Illinois in this session.
You know what? This has been around for a while. If the bill does come up for a vote, I will take a look at it, but I just want it. My position has been very clear. I am pro-life with exceptions, and I'll take a look at the bill if it's presented before the General Assembly for a vote.
Your priorities over the next week and a half then, Representative Durkin?
Pass a balanced budget and pass a fair and reasonable capital infrastructure program.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
There are lots of moving parts in the State House right now. As I mentioned earlier, the official end of session is May 31st. As you just heard Representative Durkin outline his priorities, we're joined now by Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. A little more analysis. Hi, Brian. Welcome back to the 21st. Good morning.
Hi, Nyla. Good morning. I'm just trying not to get crushed by all these moving parts around here.
Should we ban that phrase from our I will just because you said that now I will not say that for the end of session.
There's so many cliches in all news coverage, but yeah, you got to start somewhere.
So when we heard Representative Durkin talking about you have to take Republicans seriously, given the supermajorities and the numbers, do Democrats need Republican votes here?
It depends on the issue and it depends on how you're looking at it. I suppose on paper, no. The Democrats have supermajorities in the House and in the Senate, so technically they don't. But it's for some legislation, like the marijuana plan, if the governor's behind whatever proposal the House and Senate would approve, that would be a simple majority. So they could afford to lose more than a dozen votes in the House and a big number in the Senate as well. But for something like the Capitol plan, where as the governor has laid it out, part of that would require the state to issue bonds, which is a form of debt under the Illinois Constitution. In order to do that, you need a supermajority in the legislature. So, it's possible on paper that the Democrats could pass the aspects that would be controversial, like the tax hike, with their own majorities. But then, come back to the Republicans for the bonding thing if they needed to. But in reality, they want this to be a bipartisan thing, because if you're going to raise taxes, you want to get both sides on it so that it's not weaponized later if you can avoid that.
Brian, I wonder if we can focus on this Capitol bill. This is kind of one of these once in a decade bills that everyone agrees is a priority. Can you share a little bit more about the highlights of what, first of all, Governor Pritzker is proposing?
Yeah, so there are there's the spending side and the paying for it side. On the spending side, he's looking at transportation. Most of that is for roads, $12 billion for new roads and bridges, $11 billion for repairing old roads. A much smaller amount, $3.5 billion, is for mass transit, a little bit for rail. There was talk of a rail line between Chicago and the Quad Cities. And then you have smaller amounts from there going for buildings like schools, universities, higher education. We've heard a lot this spring and really for years now from higher education leaders about the infrastructure deteriorating at universities. And then a little bit of money tacked on at the end for things like solar energy projects at state buildings and things like that, broadband across the state, which $420 million we're talking about for broadband. But in the context of tens of billions of dollars in capital spending, it's kind of small.
Right. When we're thinking about $41.5 billion,
yeah,
this plan,
right,
what are we thinking are going to be the biggest sticking points here? Is it going to be, so we talked about the gas tax, there's going to be tiered increases in vehicle registration fees, a registration fee for electronic vehicles, ride sharing, taxes on streaming services.
Right, like Netflix and Hulu, and I'm not sure
7%, yeah.
Exactly. And this is something the cable industry has wanted about on satellite TV, because the cable industry pays fees for, you know, using
right,
the public's right away.
Those are those regional fee bills you have to write. That's on your bill.
Right. They, you know, they pay these fees for burying their cables on the public's right of way. Satellite people say, well, we don't need to bury cables. We beam things directly to the little dish on top of private property. But the cable industry has long wanted this equalized out. So these taxes will be the sticking point. Any one of these taxes is going to have its own interest groups, if not broad, widespread opposition to it. And that's the thing where you can start picking off individual legislators, or trying to anyway. And that's the challenge, is to hold everybody together on these.
Brian, we've just got about a minute left. I just want to ask you, we haven't talked about the budget. How is that going?
It's going. There have been there was an April surprise. I'm sure you've talked about this already. $1.5 billion in extra money that came into the state's coffers that was not expected. That has provided sort of a breathing easy around here. It's projected revenues for next year have let the governor to back off from his plan to short the pension systems by hundreds of millions of dollars,
which makes the rating agencies happy as well.
It does. It does. But, you know, there's still a long way to go. Republicans are saying, hey, we could make this bipartisan again. But it's still, you know, the Democrats say we still need to do some of these taxes, like the bag tax, things like that, increasing the cigarette tax. There are reasons beyond budgets that Democrats want to do some of these things. And so that's one of the many issues as we look at the moving parts around here that need to get unmoved by the end of May.
To get that one in there. I think you should also, A Long Way to Go is another one we probably don't want to hear, right?
We'll see what happens.
Brian Mackey is IPR's State House reporter, joining us from the State House in Springfield. Brian, thanks for being with me. I appreciate
it. Good to talk to you as always, Nyla.
Coming up, the Medicaid backlog in Illinois, what folks are trying to do about it.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Arts Museum at the University of Illinois. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and Saturday, 10 to 4. Offering a world of art right here in Champaign-Urbana. More at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. About 1 in 5 Americans have health insurance through Medicaid. It's one of the biggest federal programs in the country, but it's also run a little differently in each state. Here in Illinois, there's actually a pretty big problem right now in how our system is run. Under federal law, if you apply for Medicaid, the state needs to determine whether you're eligible within 45 days. But many Illinois residents have waited much longer than that, and as a result, are going without health insurance. How many? The most recent numbers have this at more than 112,000 people. Becky Dernbach is a freelance journalist and a graduate student at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. She reported on this issue for the Chicago Sun-Times and joins us now. Hi, Becky. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I'm also joined by Carrie Chapman and Claudia Lenhoff. Carrie is the Director of Advocacy with the Legal Counsel for Health Justice, and Claudia Lenhoff is Executive Director of Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. Both of you, welcome to the 21st as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Becky, can we start with one of the folks that you profiled in your reporting, and that's Afton Williams. She lives in El Dorado, well, that's about an hour east of Carbondale in southern Illinois. She's on Medicaid, and when her daughter was born, she tried to enroll her daughter in Medicaid. What happened when she tried to do that?
Sure. So it took about 3 months. Wiley, her baby daughter, was nearly 3 months old before she was approved for Medicaid. And so Afton was trying to take her daughter to these scheduled appointments. She had an outstanding bill for that first post-hospital checkup at 3 to 5 days. And so when she took her in for her one-month appointment for a checkup and vaccinations, the clinic turned her away and said they couldn't see her daughter unless she paid $300 up front for that checkup and vaccinations. And so she said she cried in the waiting room. She felt like a terrible parent for not being able to afford to take her daughter to the doctor. She wound up getting her vaccinations at the health department. And then meanwhile, she kept getting bills she couldn't afford. So her hospital visit when she gave birth to Wiley was covered, but she was getting separate bills for Wiley. And she was getting bills. One was nearly $8,000. And it was a very stressful time for her. She said it was super duper stressful, in her words. And so ultimately, she got in touch with a navigator who reached out to the state and helped get Wiley's coverage approved just before she turned 3 months old. And then she was able to call the hospital, get them to bill Medicaid instead of her for the birth. Wiley's back on track with her infant checkups, but those early months were very stressful for her family. She was being denied care, getting bills she couldn't afford, in throes
while just having had a baby too, right,
exactly,
Becky? Which is normally not a completely stress-free time. Carrie, I wonder if you can tell us how much you're hearing about this story. So Becky just shared us a story of Afton. With your work with the Legal Counsel for Health Justice, are we hearing stories like this all over the state?
So we are unfortunately hearing this all over the state. We're hearing it in regard to infants, and obviously that's super concerning that they're not getting care on the periodicity schedule that they're supposed to. We are hearing it about children. We're hearing it about adults and seniors. And so it's a statewide issue. Infants are a particular pain point, but it's a statewide issue. I've seen clients under 18 whose cancer care was interrupted because their Medicaid went off, and when they reapplied, their application was delayed.
Mm. So, Claudia, I know your organization helps Illinois residents navigate parts of the healthcare system. Becky mentioned that Afton had found a navigator. First of all, can you just explain the process of what's supposed to happen when someone applies for Medicaid?
So what's supposed to happen when somebody applies is it usually takes between 30 to 45 days to get a standard determination, and people should be able to count on that. It should be, you know, pretty straightforward, and they will get a letter in the mail and let them know about their coverage. We should also be able to look people up and see that their Medicaid application is pending. This is something that's very helpful when you're dealing with providers. If you don't have your Medicaid coverage yet, you can demonstrate that you've applied and that your application is pending. Of course, that's not what's happening right now. But yeah, it should be a pretty straightforward process, and people understand that it takes a little bit of time, but obviously right now it's taking much, much longer, and then these gaps in coverage are causing problems. Some people, if they need coverage much more immediately under certain circumstances, they can get their cases, they may be able to get their applications expedited by the medical management unit, and they can get a temporary card. But even that has become difficult.
Hmm. Carrie, why do we know why this is taking so long?
So I think there are a couple of reasons. I think this administration has inherited a little bit of a perfect storm. First of all, we've just had reductions in headcount in the two agencies that administer the Medicaid program, the Department of Health Care and Family Services and the Illinois Department of Human Services. And that's been going on for a pretty long time. And during the budget impasse, we felt the loss of staff and non-replacement of staff particularly acutely. Also, in the fall of 2017, the state rolled out a new computer system, and that process has been really rocky. So the first year and a half or so of the use of that computer system has been very difficult and challenging, and there have been a lot of problems. And so that's made it difficult to process applications timely. And then we also have, I think, more applications coming into the system because the new computer system has also caused problems with people renewing their Medicaid. So you have to redetermine your eligibility for Medicaid every year because it's a means-tested program. And the new computer system has a lot of glitches with those redeterminations. And so when people get improperly kicked off, they reapply. So we're driving large numbers of people into the application system who should just be re-deed and stay on Medicaid. And so really, I think this administration has come to a kind of trifecta of problems that's gotten us to where we are right now.
Like, Carrie, are you saying that basically most of these problems are because of a computer system?
So I think a lot of them are related to the computer system, yes. I don't want to underplay the fact that we have stripped headcount, bodies in chairs, in human services, because we absolutely have in Illinois, and that is a really important issue. But I think things have gotten as acute as they've gotten right now because of the challenges in rolling out the computer system. And we are not the only state that has experienced pretty extraordinary challenges. So through the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, states were given large grants to update their computer systems, both to do Medicaid expansion, which Illinois did, but also to do marketplaces for private insurance, Obamacare marketplaces. And so there were large grants, and many states chose to update their previous system. Our legacy system was extremely old. Some of it ran on DOS and definitely needed to be updated.
So that, is that what Illinois did, Carrie?
Yes. And so, yes, that's exactly what we did. And like other states, that process has been extraordinarily bumpy.
Okay. So, Carrie, who's responsible for this computer system? Is this a federal computer system? Is this Illinois administering a federal system? Is this an entirely new system we came up with in Illinois?
So we worked with a company called Deloitte, and we purchased and customized a system that Deloitte had developed for Michigan and potentially some states before Michigan. So the state of Illinois worked with Deloitte to develop this computer system built on a system that they used in Michigan with federal dollars. So our private insurance marketplace for Obamacare is jointly done with the feds. But this new computer system rollout for Medicaid is the state of Illinois and Deloitte.
Okay. That's Carrie Chapman, who's the director of advocacy for the Legal Counsel for Health Justice. We know about this backlog in part because of reporting that Becky Dernbach did for the Chicago Sun-Times. Becky, as we think about this backlog of 112,000 people or so, one of the things that was just mentioned was that if a Medicaid application takes more than 45 days to process, Illinois is supposed to issue a temporary medical card. Are those backlogged as well?
Yes, so those are also backlogged. So, so the state started issuing notices of possible entitlement to temporary medical assistance in May of last year, so a year ago now. So a letter in the mail saying you might possibly be entitled to temporary benefits, but that's not the same as actually getting temporary benefits. So you get that letter, and then you still have to request them, which is a process that is not necessarily straightforward for everybody. And so the number of actual temporary cards is very low. So, for example, in February of this year, the state issued 30,000 notices saying you might possibly be entitled to temporary medical benefits, but only issued about 2,000 actual temporary medical cards. So that's about 7% of the number who were notified they might qualify for this assistance.
Wow. Claudia, as we're thinking about this, clearly this is something that needs to be fixed. But when we're thinking about the harm done to people's health, I'm thinking of what you said about having kids, children who've had to stop their or had problems maybe halting cancer treatments, people who've had to go without health coverage. I wonder what you're hearing from other clients in Central Illinois who've had their applications held up. How are they handling this?
Well, we're hearing the same things, and, you know, there are people who have their procedures canceled because they can't demonstrate that they have health coverage, and it's really a crisis. In terms of what people can do, in our community in Champaign County, we're pretty fortunate that we can work with healthcare providers to apply patients for financial assistance. And a lot of times that can relieve the debt burden and give them access to care until their coverage kicks in. But not every community has the same kind of healthcare infrastructure to be able to do that. And also, financial assistance doesn't always apply to all the different kinds of procedures and care that people need. The other big problem that we see is that, you know, a lot of times people are finding out at the pharmacy when they go to refill their prescriptions that they don't have health coverage. The problem is not just the backlog. The problem is also that health coverage is getting dropped for people inexplicably and without reason. And then they find out when they go to a healthcare provider or to the pharmacy and then they can't afford to take their pay for their medications. And so we're seeing people's lives also being disrupted because they might have a chronic health issue which needs management through regular medication, and they can't get their medications. And so we have to help with that. And at Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, we have an RX fund, a prescription drug fund, where we can help people. We can sort of provide a bridge for them to cover their medications until their Medicaid gets reinstated or it kicks in. But it really is a crisis for people.
Carrie, when we're thinking about this crisis, there's also been a lawsuit, and I know that there was a lawsuit, I believe this was filed last year, right, by the Shriver Center, because all of this is actually under federal law illegal, what Illinois is doing. Has that lawsuit changed or created any kind of sense of urgency around this issue?
So I think it has. So the lawsuit was filed by Shriver, the Shriver Center, my organization, legal counsel, with support from Sidley Austin. And it was actually a motion to enforce an existing court order that required the state to give those notices of T cards, temporary cards, and to actually give temporary Medicaid that Becky was just talking about. So the reason they started issuing those notices and issuing those temporary cards in May was as a result of the lawsuit. So they hadn't really planned to be issuing T cards. They hadn't built the functionality directly into the computer system until we sued. So some progress has been made because those notices are going out. But Becky points out a really important challenge, which is that we really still don't have the infrastructure to take those requests. So people are going to their local offices and standing in line, not being able to get in. Those local offices are really overwhelmed. And so you might come with your notice but not leave with a T-card. It's really not possible to get a T-card either by emailing a request or faxing a request or calling to request them, which are three ways that our clients in particular can really take advantage of communicating with the state. And it's not really possible to get a T-card that way. And so we still need to, and people don't know. There's just, even people don't necessarily read that notice, they don't get that notice, or they don't understand that notice. And so we haven't penetrated out into the community the fact that this is a thing that is real and that they can get an active Medicaid card quickly. And so we continue to negotiate with the state to try to get them to be more aggressive in making sure people really understand how to get T cards and they make more avenues available to get those cards. It's not a panacea, but if more people knew about T cards and if the ability to get them was easier, then I know we would see higher numbers than we're seeing now. People want the cards. If you said, so you applied for this Medicaid, do you actually want it or would you rather wait 3 more months? The answer is I want it now.
Right. We're almost out of time, but Becky, I wonder just how the state has responded to this. What are we hearing from Governor Pritzker, the Department of Health Care and Family Services? What did they say when you asked them about this, Becky?
Sure. So they say they are bringing on additional staff and technical support. They say this is a high priority for the Pritzker administration. They also say that in the past 2 months, they have eliminated the backlog of 26,500 newborn applications. And Governor Pritzker was asked at a press conference last week about the backlog, and he said that they are going to be working to reduce it in the next months and year, and we'll announce steps if you give us a little bit of time. And meanwhile, the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has notified the state, that's the federal agency that oversees Medicaid, they've notified the state that they're out of compliance on timely determinations of eligibility, and they've asked the state for a corrective action plan.
So we're almost, again, we just really quickly, Claudia, I wonder if you can let us know what you think needs to be done now?
Well, there's some legislation in place or that's being worked on that would create greater transparency and accountability and make the system work better. But I think ultimately, you know, Deloitte has made millions, hundreds of millions of dollars off of the state of Illinois. And I think that these system glitches might be more than glitches. They might be features. And, you know, I think this contract with Deloitte really needs to be audited and reviewed. And probably Deloitte needs to reimburse the state of Illinois. And, you know, we need to get people the coverage that they need as soon as possible. Meanwhile, individuals in the community are picking up the pieces and trying to make things work. And it's just not right.
Right. And I'm thinking about not just hospitals, but individuals all trying to support people who are on Medicaid. I want to thank, that's Claudia Linhoff with Champaign County's Healthcare, Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. Carrie Chapman has been with us as well. She's the Director of Advocacy for Legal Counsel for Health Justice. And I want to thank Becky Dernbach for bringing the story to us. She's a freelance journalist. She's a graduate student, actually, at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism and reported on this for the Sun-Times. We'll tweet out Becky's story for those of you who are interested in reading more about it. But Becky, Carrie, Claudia, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 1992, the AIDS epidemic was still claiming many lives in Chicago. This was also a time when people often didn't speak words like gay or AIDS in public. So when Chicago drag queen Ms. Joan Jett Black started a bid to be U.S. president, it certainly made headlines. The story is the subject of a new play that premieres at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago this week. It's written by the Oscar award-winning writer behind Moonlight, Steppenwolf ensemble member Terrell Avid McCraney, and one of his longtime collaborators, Tina Landau, who's also the director. Tina's also an award-winning ensemble member who may be best known as the creator of the SpongeBob SquarePants the musical, which ended its Broadway run last year. Now, both of them have teamed up to write this play, which will run through July 14th at Steppenwolf. I had a chance to catch up with Tina last week at Steppenwolf in Chicago. Tina Landau, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you about this. Thanks.
So I wonder if we can just start with this kind of incredible story. I was reading some Chicago Reader stories of Miss Joan Jett Black's run for both mayor and then president. This play is based on this true story. How did you come to find out about the first drag queen that ran for president in the 90s?
I love that you say first. Maybe only, but definitely first. I was looking through a book called Out and Proud in Chicago, and I literally came across an item, a small entry on this amazing person, and knew instantly it was a story that had not been told, and it was a local story and an unknown story and a queer story and a story that directly speaks to this moment in time in our country, even though it takes place in 1992. And I had also been looking for a piece for Terrell to star in, my co-writer, Terrell McCraney. And I'd been trying to get him to act for years, and he had agreed. And we had a slot at Steppenwolf, but had no idea what to do in it. So when I saw this entry in the book, I immediately said, that's it. I actually stood up in my office and started screaming, that's it, that's it. And that's how we began.
And so I want to get to Terrell's return to the stage. I believe it's the first time in 15 years, if I'm correct. But first, I just want to hear a little bit more about the story, because you actually had a chance to sit down and talk to Mr. Smith, who is the man behind the drag queen that is Joan Jett Black.
Yes, exactly. It took me a little bit to find him, Terrence Allen Smith, who has since become a dear friend. He resides in San Francisco, where I finally found him after 6 months of searching, because there are a lot of Terrence Smiths in the United States of America. And I knew nothing about him, knew nothing of where he was, what he was doing. When we made contact, he was delighted, he was moved, and he was shocked. He just had no idea that two people would come a knocking at his door saying, this story matters a lot and we need to tell it. And I flew to San Francisco, and I talked to him over about 12, 14 hours, like a really marathon session that I recorded and transcribed. And the words were helpful, but the most helpful thing was just being in his presence, because he still has that thing that I think made Joan Jett Black so extraordinary, which is a kind of light and positive energy and joie de vivre and gusto and a very forward political sensibility. And after I talked to Terrence, neither Terrell nor I wanted to start on the piece until we knew that he would be on board and felt comfortable sharing his story. And he was. And so when I got back, Terrell and I began. And the intent was to try to walk this fine line of sharing the facts of an amazing piece of our history, and at the same time to not be bound by a kind of pedestrian or documentary telling, that the spirit that Joan brought into the campaign was as important to us as the dry facts of the events. So we definitely tell the story from the night she announced her candidacy to the night she gets on the floor of the Democratic National Convention in New York. But hopefully we are doing it in a way that has some surprise and whimsy and fabulousness.
And so when we think about this, just the whole idea that she ran for president, I was very amused when I was reading a newspaper story where she said, it's a campaign. We want to take the pain out of this, and we want to make sure there's a lot of camp in this. How did you guys try to figure out the writing process of this?
Yeah. Well, we really took our cue from Terrence Joan. So many of her one-liners are that delicious as what you just said. You know, one of the slogans of her campaign was, if a bad actor can be president, why not a good drag queen? You know, so there were kind of phrases like that that we could hang our hats on. What's remarkable about what she did is it's both camp, in quotes, campy in that way, but the whole intention behind the campaign was really to draw attention to issues of queer visibility and issues around the AIDS epidemic, which was at its height at the time. So Joan and Queer Nation did their actions partly through a camp sensibility, but the actions themselves were political in intent. And so in writing the piece, we tried to keep one foot in both of those worlds. So, you know, there is performance in the show, and there's song, and there's dancing, and there's drag. And at the same time, it's set very firmly in the context of those Bush years, or, you know, the end of the Reagan era into the Bush years, and what was going on in this country and in this city with the AIDS epidemic.
So I wonder if you can take us to 1992, because, I mean, even the idea, first of all, even I would think the term lesbian and gay is not something that people are talking about on nightly news, let alone drag queen. So what was Joan Jett Black's intent, political intent, in this campaign?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. It was such an amazing time, because you're right about that. I mean, you know, the first kiss of two gay people hadn't happened on TV. And it sounds so recent, 92, at least to me it does, because I was alive and I remember it. But when I go back and look what was going on, it does sometimes feel like the Dark Ages in terms of certain issues. Queer Nation, first of all, took this word queer, which had been a derogatory slur word, and the notion was to reclaim it and to turn queer into something that was powerful and involved pride. And the Queer Nation and ACT UP activists didn't have time to be polite. They knew what needed to happen, and they knew it needed to happen now because people were dying. So the approach to all of their actions was very in-your-face, bold, graphic, and Joan was part of that. I mean, the intention was to get attention, to say, it wasn't to say we're nice and polite and, you know, there's a strain in the show that talks about kind of some of the conflict that went on between the out and proud and loud gay community and the more assimilationist, we want to prove we're just like you and we dress like you and we can fit in. And Joan was definitely of the former. And so her intent was to make noise. It was to be heard. It was to be seen. It wasn't to get elected president. But the way to be heard and to be seen and to draw attention to the issues was to launch a run so she would have a platform to get attention so she could speak what she needed to.
I'm speaking with Tina Landau, who's the director and co-writer of a play that's opening this week at Steppenwolf. So you have produced, you know, a lot of Broadway. I'm thinking of SpongeBob the Musical. How do you go from SpongeBob the Musical to a play about a drag queen? Actually, are there a lot of similar elements here?
Yes, that's the whole point. They feel of a kind to me, honestly. They're both shows about outsiders, the marginalized. I mean, you know, laugh as you will, but Bikini Bottom, which is the world of SpongeBob, is a world made up of eccentrics and kooks who come to understand the importance of community. And on that level, I can say they're versions of the same piece. They're both pieces that at core are about joy in some ways and hope. So honestly, I'm not even aware of that difference. I feel like I'm in a room again where we're making something from scratch. And because Terrell and I are both writing and he's acting in it and I'm directing, we're in a room where we're just making stuff up as we go, kamikaze, DIY. And that's how we made SpongeBob too.
And that joy, I wonder if you could speak to that, because we started this conversation with you saying that you really feel like this was something that happened in 1992. This is the Queer Nation Party really taking a stand and trying to inject a conversation about healthcare, about LGBT rights, about AIDS. And I wonder how you think something like this, which does seem in some ways like recent history, but then also seems like very far away when we think of the fact that in 1992, people probably weren't even saying AIDS. Like, that was not even something people would talk about. How do you think that fits in America 2019?
Well, there are a couple things. One is, when I say joy, that is joy that is born out of necessity. That is joy that is required to survive the plague years, if you will, or the years we're going through now. It's not a joy that doesn't know its opposite. You know, when one is in the trenches fighting for your lives, one of the activists said this, joy is what we needed to survive. So as much pain and loss as there was at the time, there was also the absolute necessity of singing and dancing. In terms of the parallels of the time, it's really like crazy, scary, uncanny. You know, having gone through, well, there's so many parallels. The Anita Hill hearings, like, happened right before the action of this play. The Rodney King and the L.A. riots, police brutality. There's so many kind of landmark events that echo ones that we are living through again. And when I look at 1992 and work on the piece, I'm aware of two things being simultaneously true. One is how far we've come, how much we've changed, and the other is how things are just the same. And both of those are true. But I do know that the people who were mobilized in that era to stand up and do something, some of that DNA exists right now, especially in young people who I sense in this moment in time in our country are mobilizing in ways that haven't happened for a long time. And it feels similar in that regard. It feels like a moment where there's really no choice but to be vocal and to have to speak up, because the consequences of doing otherwise are too dire.
Do you feel then like you want particularly young activists to draw inspiration from this story? I mean, this is a story I think the vast majority of people, not just in Chicago, but across Illinois and the country, really don't know about.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it just feels so important to get to know and unearth and remember our legacy, because that is what we have to build on. It's what we have to inspire us, and it's what we have to move forward from. And I know Terrell and I have been deeply inspired by Terrence and what was accomplished. Someone said to me recently, well, but Joan lost the campaign. And I said, that was not the point at all. And what a victory to stand in those heels in that moment, in that room, and say some of the things she said. you know, it's all about context. But yeah, we want people to know this story because we need to build on it. And we need to hear Terrence's voice in our heads saying what he said to us in rehearsal, which was jump, go, leap. That's what he said when we said, what advice would you give to young people today? And that was his answer. Like, jump, do it. Very simple.
Tina Landau, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. This was wonderful.
That's all the time we have for. Before we go, the city of Chicago is making history about another victory this morning.
I, Lori Elaine Lightfoot, do solemnly swear.
That was minutes ago, Lori Lightfoot being sworn into office as Chicago's 56th mayor. She's the first Black woman and first openly gay person to hold the position. Mayor Lightfoot was considered a political outsider when she first launched her campaign, but eventually won a landslide victory.
Discharge the duties of the office of mayor. Of the office of mayor. Of the city of Chicago.
Of the city of Chicago.
According to the best of my ability.
According to the best of my ability.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. And I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.